Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, beginning the second full week of June version of Conversation Radio on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. This is, of course, the 8th day of June, 2015. If you'd like to be part of the real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room, run right by HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. Pick yourself out a screen name and a password and jump right in. And a little of that as we say good evening to Anatole and Jeremy in Vermont, Jug of Punch and Texas T, alongside Will from Chicago and Sparky, chat room moderator, longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky. Good evening, everybody. More folks will be wandering by to further the rollicking, madcap, zany shenanigans in the chat room. Jeremy in Vermont noting loud and clear on TuneIn, Bob. Congrats to your youngest once again. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very kindly. Randy noting loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac. Wonderful. Although we are not listed on iTunes yet. iTunes Radio, we're still working on that. But hopefully we will be, and it'll be a wonderful day when we are. For now, though, you know, there's TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio and Roku devices, and, of course, the easiest way is simply to use the Listen Live button at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. You can also get all the various and sundry stream links over at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Yeah, it was a very busy weekend. And I'm sure many of you, some of you, I don't know, well, some of you, not many of you, it doesn't. But some of you have seen the pictures from Doodle's graduation this weekend. I was very proud of her. And you want to talk about an ethic? Now, she busted her butt to get her CNA certification, because that's the beginning of pursuing ultimately what she wants her career to be. She wants to go into nursing. And I find that both noble and admirable. But it's one thing to say, I want to go into nursing. And it's another thing to graduate on Friday and start working in your chosen field the following Monday. This is not the privileged summer after graduation when the children of the 1% go off to the beach or backpacking in Europe or any of that sort of thing. No, Doodle graduated from high school on Friday. We had a huge family feast for her on Saturday. She decompressed on Sunday, and early this morning, she went off to work her very first job. And she's home now, and probably worn out. But it's a wonderful experience for her, because the next thing I know, we'll be celebrating, a couple of years hence probably, we'll be celebrating her, the awarding of her RN degree. And I have to applaud that kind of drive. And thank you to everyone, all the members of the Horn Family Commune congregation who extended your good wishes to her. She was really tickled with it. She really, really was. It meant a great deal to her because, of course, y'all have seen and listened to her grow up over the years. It's kind of hard to imagine every now and then it kind of gets brought home. How long this little conversation has been going on. Wowzer. It's been going on since Doodle was 6 years old. I posted one photo on Sunday of her on her first day of school and her last day of high school in her cap and gown. And the horn's been going on just about that long. Thanks again. Thanks again. And Mercy, my sister and brother-in-law did come up from the Gulf, and what a feast. What a feast. So, thank you, Steve. Steve with an email says, my grandma had a name for what you just described. Your daughter had a good bringings up. We hope so. We hope so. She's had a lot of help from her eldest sister and her brother-in-law as well. And she's been there it was nice to spend more time with the grandbabies again this weekend. Talk about growing up fast. Well, if I'm not careful, I maybe look around and maybe be old someday. Yes, I know what day it is. How could I not? But before we get to the festivities, I wanted to share a note with you. We just heard from Steve saying Doodle had good bringings up. But Steve sat down to write a lengthy email. I mean, you know, it's not, you know, gone with the wind or anything, but when people take the time to write an email of, you know, depth and consideration, I like to share them. Steve says, I'm not sure why I'm writing to my fellow Hornedonistas about something like this. I guess it's because I just need somewhere to vent. If that's all I've done, I'm sorry. Well, no need to apologize. Sometimes venting is the healthiest thing we can do. However, I think in one sense it demonstrates how much the rich, powerful, and their government, not mine or ours, has come to enslave us. A couple of years ago, I wrote to the Horn about my personal financial troubles. I wrote about how I was working for someone who didn't pay me enough to pay my taxes. They were paying me as a 1099, which was likely wrong of them, but that's another story, so they weren't taking out taxes. In any event, my expenses actually exceeded my income. I wasn't making that much money. Finally, I got to a point where I wanted to just go ahead and catch up, so I hired an accountant friend of mine to file all this stuff and try to catch up. I filed paperwork this past March to go on a payment plan. I was unemployed at the time, so I proposed what I could pay at the time, move ahead, and 3 months to when the IRS finally called me to discuss. I now have a temp gig that will go for a while. However, I make 22% less than I was making at the job I had before being let go on January 2nd, 2015, my birthday. The person from the IRS starts asking me questions about my finances, the same questions that I filled out on the form 3 months ago. Mind you, in 3 prior conversations, never did she say what she was going to be talking to me about, but that's a different issue. She asked me what I could afford. The number I said I could afford was 1/3 of what they said I owed. When I got off the phone, I was flabbergasted. At no time over the past couple of years have I ever taken a vacation, purchased a car, or any luxury item. I'm 44 years old. I live with a roommate because rent is so high where I live. I have no savings. As I've thought about this, it occurs to me that I'm beginning to feel like all of us who rely on our labor for our living are nothing more than serfs to this behemoth that is the state. My inclinations are to socialism, collective action to solve problems via the government, for instance. However, my personal views seem to be libertarian, which frankly bugs me. Yet when I look at how this government treats laboring people, I don't know how anyone can say what this entity we have is not a blood-sucking, life-sucking, enslaving, and yes, criminal syndicate akin to the mob in the way it treats citizens who labor. How is it that a corporation gets to deduct its normal daily expenses before it pays its taxes? How is it that taxes on non-labor income, investment income, etc., are lower, much lower in most instances, than taxes on labor? How is it that the government gets to skim its pound of flesh off the top before you even get to see your paycheck? I don't want to sound like a libertarian. I don't want to sound like some ignorant teabagger. But this sounds like words that come out of their mouths. I'm truly at a point where the situation looks fundamentally unfair to me. In fact, it goes beyond unfair to patently oppressive. How is it that real live flesh and blood people are taxed higher and less favorably than pieces of paper, corporations? How is it that a person's labor is taxed at a higher rate than income from not actually doing anything? How is it that I have to pay taxes to buy weaponry to kill people in far-off places who've never done anything to me? How is it that I have to pay taxes to subsidize corporations that make billions in profits? How is it that the government wants me to pay more taxes than ExxonMobil or any number of multinationals who don't pay taxes? How is it that I have to pay for government contractors, for prisons for profit, for spying on my fellow citizens, for militarizing police, for foreign aid to people in other parts of the world, while significant numbers of my fellow citizens have poisoned water, live in squalor, or don't have access to basic health care? I'm sorry, but why do we continue to feed this blood-sucking behemoth with our tax dollars? Why do we stand by and continue to let the state tax our labor while Wall Street receives a bailout when they tanked our economy, probably permanently changing it forever and creating a world of low-wage jobs? Bob, I'm sorry to say this, but the DVD players, digital TVs, iPhones, cable, and other modern conveniences are nothing but the trinkets of an infantilized people foisted upon us to distract us from the theft of the benefit of our labor. This is all about enslaving us with debt, whether it's education debt, housing debt, or consumer debt, tied up in cars, houses, trinkets, and shiny objects, and then enslaving us with taxes to subsidize the companies that sell us this crap. We are dupes for continuing to pay taxes to support this monstrosity. It is our oppressor. I come full circle. I think I'm a believer in collective activity to solve problems, to put money and effort into the pot. I think I'm 100% for the notion of those who benefit the most owe the most and should contribute the most. However, if what we have is, in fact, what that looks like, then I'm actually not for it. If what we have is what collective action looks like, count me out. If this is it, then keep your police protection and fire protection and roads and courts and any number of items that constitute the commons. Sorry to vent, says Steve. I read that this morning, and I've been thinking about it all day. And I can see where Steve may think, hi Steve, may think that that sounds libertarian, because a lot of those words are the sorts of words that are aped, and I do mean aped, by the right wing, by the booger eaters, the birchers, the baggers, the deathers, the tenthers, the ninthers, the libertarians. They're stealing of my liberty because we're going to pave some roads. I'm that much less free, and I'm not mocking Steve. I'm mocking baggers, birthers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, booger eaters, and libertarians. Because it's a case of being, perhaps, in their instance, right for the wrong reasons. Everything Steve mentions here of being so as being so disgusting to him is absolutely correct. But that collective action is not what we're getting. Now, I've got some 8 years of life on Steve, and many of you have lots more than that on Steve and on me, too. And so, while I can remember it, I'm sure there are those who remember it much more vividly, that there was a time when the middle class in this country got to itemize taxes almost the way corporations do. But then came, and I'm not sure where, if Rick in Southern California is listening or not. He often participates on Friday on the Front Porch. Hi, Rick. But then came the Tax Reform Act of 1986. See, once upon a time, Ma and Pa American could deduct the interest that they paid on credit cards on their federal income taxes. Once upon a time, Ma and Pa American could deduct the interest that they paid on car loans from their federal income taxes. And yes, there were certain abuses of the system, one of the more charming ones being... if you go to YouTube and look for it, you'll find a comment from Keith Olbermann from his ESPN program about Harry Carey's notebooks. There was a time when working people kept notebooks if they were really, really sharp. And they would sit down, and in Harry Carey's case, apparently, he kept track of every beer he ever bought anybody else in the world and handed it over to his accountant at tax time. Well, you might recall that 1986 falls right smack dab in the middle of the horrible terror years of Ronald Reagan, when we were told that trickle-down economics was going to be the salvation of us all, as we sat below the 1% dinner table and just lapped up that steady stream of wealth that flowed through the blood gutters around the table and down over the corner into our waiting mouths. The Tax Reform Act of 1986 created a new normal, and it's an ugly new normal. No longer could the interest on a car note be itemized. No longer, Harry Carey, once upon a time, in the world of baseball, which has 162 games per season, there were businessman's lunch Thursday. And those were Thursday home games, whatever city you were in, that would start early in the afternoon. And they were designed for the people in the community. Of course, this is before a ticket to a baseball game was a $500 proposition once you factored in the hot dogs and the pop and the beer and everything and the great big foam fingers. But business people in the community, your local banker, car salesman, insurance guy, the manager of your local Sears would get some friends together or use tickets as an employee reward system and go out and take an early day from work and sit in the sun and watch grown men play a little boy's game and for a couple of hours dream that they were not cogs in some great economic machine, but they were fans of the home team. And that stuff got written off. And somehow or another, all that was going on during a time when the economic prosperity of this country was in pretty, well, it was prosperous. Good shape. But by 1986, all that begins to disappear. It disappears, among other things, into the maws of Wall Street. It disappears into the memory hole of Harvard MBAs, you know, more bigger assholes, who began to be worried about productivity. And by God, those businessmen's lunch and Thursday baseball games, they were cutting into American productivity. much of the civilized world still maintains something along the lines of what the Spanish the Spanish-speaking world refers to as the siesta. The shops close down from noon to 2. Go home, have lunch, kiss the spouse, catch a nap. It's good for you. And then come back and open up and do business till a little later in the day. We've never gotten around to that notion of humane leisure in this country because the business of America is business. And your purpose in life is to eat and excrete and die. And somewhere in the middle of it all, make some corporate billionaire a little more billionaire-ish. Because freedom and the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever. So, Steve, don't be surprised by the fact that you feel rather oppressed. You are. It has not always been this way. See, the Great Tax Reform Act of 1986, you might remember historically, was also one of those moments that Chris Matthews gets all damp in his maiden forms over when he goes to talking about how Tip O'Neill really knew how to compromise with the Gipper, with old Dutch Reagan, golly gosh, gee whiz willikers. When in point of fact, what Tip O'Neill did was fold like a cheap suit to the malicious, bloodthirsty desires of a right wing run absolutely rampant in this country. And that was one of those beginning points. That's why that's one of those places where it's very easy to look at the Reagan presidency and go, oh, that's where we got it. No, oh, wow. Right in the shorts. Once upon a time, student loan interest debt would have been deductible. But the 1986 Tax Reform Act was a game of smoke and mirrors and moving shells with peas under them. And find the queen. It's easy. See, here's the queen. Find the queen. All done to make it look like the phony baloney economic voodoo, as George H.W. Bush rightly called it, was actually good for this country. Oh, there were other things, like the fact that until the Reagan administration, we had never counted the military in the employment numbers, but unemployment was so brutal that in order to make St. Ronnie look like he was actually doing something, suddenly the military were counted in the employment numbers. Hey, look, the unemployment numbers are going down. We need a big... Hey, well, Mommy, I guess we need a million man armies, what we need. Which, of course, opened the gaping maws of the military-industrial congressional complex to something we now recognize as the poverty draft. Where we don't have a draft per se, but it's about the only thing that's available in certain poverty-ridden areas of our country. I sat and listened to the mercifully brief addresses by the class president and the valedictorian and the salutatorians. There were two. Friday evening, and on more than one occasion were mentions of where the fellows and ladies, young ladies of the class will be going, and as mentioned, and some of you will go into our professional military. And I'm not anti-military, but I sat there on some of the most uncomfortable bleachers I have ever experienced in my life, and asked, why? Why? Because I'll warrant you that the number of people entering the military from that little high school is a greater percentage per capita than a high school in, say, Beverly Hills or the Hamptons. Do you doubt me? Because I think I'm probably on pretty firm ground here. It's been graduation season all over Central Appalachia here. And some of you will be going into the professional military has probably been repeated hundreds, if not thousands, of times. Unstated within that is the parenthetical, and some of you won't come home. Because you're going to go and, with tax dollars, be very poorly compensated. And you're going to die in some war of empire on behalf of an oil company or an extraction company bent on the preservation of rights of access to rare earth minerals in Afghanistan or Iraq. That'll figure into more on Monday, too. So I guess what I'm trying to say to Steve, or in response to Steve's note, is that what you're objecting to is not the country as it was intended to be 1954 presidency up to the Reagan presidency. What you're objecting to, Steve, is the triumphant rise of corporate well-being over human well-being. Because you know what? The Supreme Court can say corporations are people too now, my friend, all they want to, but they can't say corporations, and they didn't say, because somebody might actually violate their 350-foot buffer zone if they did. The rats of SCOTUS, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, and that Kennedy kid, did not say that corporations are human beings. We retain that, by God, and we retain it by virtue of the stripes upon our back. Lashes laid on by the 1%. Lashes laid on by ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell and BP. Lashes laid on by Alpha Natural Resources and Peabody and Arch Coal. Laid on our backs until they have the tender X-mark grid panel as if we had been laid on a hot grill and scorched real good. And what Steve says about our electronic gizmos is absolutely correct. But the gizmos ye shall have always with ye. Just a different time. The gizmos we now have are a direct result of the opening of Chinese industrial potential. Because when you get right down to it, the Chinese government doesn't much care about the individuals of its so-called communist collective. It doesn't much matter if, frankly, they're easier to manage if you've got them working 6 days a week for 12 hours a day than if they're out there on a subsistence farm living some happy version of existence which has been pretty much okay for them, you know, for the past 6,000 years. Because those folks periodically get uppity. But man, if you've got them on the industrial campus, I'm sorry, the plantation. And if people, and if you've got it set up so that no two people speaking the same dialect even work next to each other. And if you've got it set up so that they can't even sit down or take more than one or maybe two bathroom breaks in a 12-hour shift. And you're feeding them a little bit of rice and a little bit of rat for lunch. You've got things pretty well under control. And that's where the gizmos come from. They used to come from Japan. Because the only answer we have ever had is capitalism for building an economy. And in the wake of the Second World War, we felt it would be wise to rebuild the economies that we were forced to destroy by virtue of the former enemy nation's participation in global fascism. And hey, look, we've become the fascists. Charming, isn't it? Not at all. So I hope, Steve, that manages to be some sort of a response, and certainly not a critique, of your thoughts as set out in your note earlier today. Because it sure got me thinking. It sure did. And by the way, you guys sometimes are better than I. I didn't have to say a word about fundraising, but I got a note from Randy. Said I'm hoping somebody will match my offer. Randy putting forward $50 and hoping someone will match it. That would go a long way toward the evening's fundraising goal. We try to raise $200 per program, and that goes toward keeping all of this on the air. Like, Steve, I don't remember any vacations. I mean, I remember a few years ago taking off 2 weeks sick and living on narcotics and water after a nasty gut flare-up. But vacations? Well, heck, even when we were kindly provided a trip on the lib boat, we wound up working that week. Truly, we did. But just to go away and be gone away, to be gone, I can't remember in ages. Gone for a while when Dad died. That was not a vacation. But that's Steve, and that's me, and that's a whole bunch of America. Paid vacation? What? Ah! And then the ultimate manifestation of the con there is that there are some jobs in this country where we'll give you 3 weeks of paid vacation. And you go, great, that's awesome. Maybe we'll take the kids to Disney World. And then you find out a year into the job, well, when the hell am I ever going to take it? Right. Or the bullshit myth of comp time. Please. It's all part of the face of a changing and much more brutal America. But anyway, thank you very kindly to Randy. And if someone will match Randy, that will be half of what we need to raise this evening. We've got about $1,000 in bills to pay this week and about $1,000 to raise this week. So we need to stay current. If we could raise more than today, and then that makes it better for tomorrow, wonderful that way too. Because this is, after all, listener-supported broadcasting, listener-supported conversation. If you want to help out, the PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com. It is there that you go and you click on the tab Contribute and you fill out. You can leave the nosy fields blank and just get to the next screen where you make all your PayPal choices. Credit card, cash, your PayPal account, whatever. And then away you go, and you know that you have helped out in keeping all of this going. And thanks, by the way, thanks to our subscribers. We have a small handful of monthly subscribers, and wonderful people they are. Thank you going out to our longtime friend and my grass mowing buddy, Dennis, down in Kentucky, and thanks to Kevin in Colorado Springs. Thanks to Harold. Your subscription arrived. Thank you very kindly, Harold. And thank you very much to Michael. And to Grant. Thank you indeed. If you would like to participate in the subscription process, it's right there too, and you just click a number and however much you want to do on a monthly basis, and you can set it and forget it. If you don't like to use PayPal, of course, you can always use the U.S. Postal Service. They're still sending the mails despite the Republican Party's fervent desire to see them go away and be replaced by FedEx and UPS, who will happily send an envelope across the United States for $15. Right. But the address is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. With a gentle reminder that all checks and money orders should be made payable to The Horn. And not Bob Kincaid. Ron and Raleigh with a note. Says, I keep wondering. The 1986 Tax Reform Act came along at the beginning of my peak earning years. I saw things begin to unravel financially for the middle class. What I wonder about is, how has this bullshit managed to hold on for so long? Do people really believe that trickle-down actually works when it's so obvious to anyone with a working brain cell that they can see it for the absolute pile of crap that it is? And I don't think anybody believes it. Well, I don't think anybody believes it who isn't getting paid to believe it. Let's put it that way. More than anything else, people know, the American people know they're being robbed and screwed. But they have so far given up any sense of, and this is a dangerous word, faith in the American form of government that they don't see any solutions. I mean, there was a poll to this effect in the last couple of weeks. The numbers were quite startling. On the one hand, people recognize that we're getting effed. And what's more, they know who's doing the effing. They disagree with Citizens United, for instance. But then if you turn around and ask the American people, and can anything be done about this, they go, nope. Because for a big chunk of the American of the American body politic, they can't do anything about this. They're already working 80 hours a week. When? And I realize there are people who do find extra time, a little less sleep, a little less food, a little less family time. I understand that, to go and engage in a silent vigil or a lonely protest. But for most of America, when? And if they do begin to get their backs up, because we operate in a perpetual campaign season now that's just one long wealth transfer from the bottom to the top, enriching the for-profit media, well, by the time they think they might, if they get to think they, if they think about standing up on their own hind legs, Then there's wave after wave of political ads telling them that America's already great enough. Or that, you know, that liberal is gonna send you off to the FEMA re-education camps. I mean, Jesus Christ, I posted a picture on Facebook over the weekend, last night as a matter of fact, or yesterday evening. Of something we saw driving around the bucolic West Virginia countryside over the weekend. And, I mean, it was some beautiful country we were in. By the way, Haley in Arkansas says, that's a great letter by Steve. Opening up the evening's program. Thank you, Haley. But we were driving around the bucolic West Virginia countryside, and, you know, not all of southern West Virginia is kind of straight up and down. Little narrow, narrow river valleys and narrow hollers, and that line from You'll Never Leave Harlan Alive seems very true, you know, where the sun comes up about 10 in the morning and the sun goes down about 3 in the day. There are places like that. It's more rolling hillsides where we were. Gently rolling hills. Not the dramatic stuff that's, for instance, around here. It's farm country in a way. A lot of cattle ranching. And the green, my God, the green. And by the way, just going to mention this. If you ever have need to be doing anything special in West Virginia, and like say you want to have a picnic or a family reunion or something like that, you're in the general area covered by, say, from around Parkersburg over to, say, Jane Lou, maybe a little south, and down through, Jackson County, Gilmer County, Wirt County, Calhoun, Roan, Clay, Nicholas, etc. Bank on one thing, because it's been this way for decades. It never rains. Yeah, I know. The California contingent of the Horn family is going, no, really, it never rains. It never rains on the first Saturday in June. Just doesn't. weddings, anniversaries, big parties, frog jumping contests, whatever. If you've got first Saturday in June, it's magic. And so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday were absolutely picture postcard perfect for being out and around in central West Virginia. And the highways there aren't quite as windy, and they're certainly not ground to gravel by coal trucks. This is fracking country. But the water's been poison around there for so long, and the cancer clusters have been going for so long, that it just seems normal that a lot of people get cancer. I'll never forget a long time ago when our yellow Labrador retriever went swimming in a... because a lab will find a pond and get in it, because it's just, you know, it's hardwired. And she went swimming in the pond out in front of our house and came out, and a couple of days later, all her hair fell out. It had been gas drilling country for a long time. So we were, I had seen this place on a previous run, and I remembered it in time on the last time we were going by to stop and get a picture. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that is usually soundtracked with the, what is it, Tchaikovsky? Is it from the 1812? The ta 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 ta. You know, it's just pastoral as hell. I know when Warner Brothers uses it, there's usually some birds chirping and flying around, and the sun's coming up and everything. It was like that. And so there's a driveway with two concrete lions on either side of a dual gravel track driveway leading under trees and, you know, great leafy green foliage to a two-story house with a columned front porch. It wasn't quite Terra, but, you know, this is West Virginia. It couldn't be. And you just look at it and you say, my, oh, my, isn't that pretty? The picture's on my Facebook page. And then, because my eyes are drawn to these things, I guess, I've become, since January 2009, or maybe, you know, the 2008 presidential campaign season, I just home in on them. And there it sat. Just to the right, naturally, of the right-hand side concrete lion. And, I mean, this is a nice-looking place, you know, the picnic table under the trees, potted flowers by the driveway. Gorgeous. Just lovely. A homemade sign. Looks like it was lettered by Jethro Bodine on his best day. It started out as Obama's Lies and Deceit. Parentheses. Remember, close parentheses, Benghazi. Naturally, they misspelled being birthers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, baggers, booger eaters, birchers, libertarians, what have you. They misspelled Benghazi. It is Benghazi. You missed it by that much. And then later on, they had to add on to the sign, so they took another little white board. Naturally, it's a whiteboard with black letters, and added Hillary Clinton and. So it'll read Hillary Clinton and Obama's Lies and Deceit. Paren, remember, close paren, Benghazi. And then there's some other poster next to it of a soldier kneeling and I couldn't quite make out the words on that one, but Hillary Clinton and Obama's lies and deceit. Remember Benghazi? Well, that's enough. But then again, maybe the reason I'm drawn to these things is because liberals and progressives have to exist, if for no other reason than to correct the spelling on teabagger protest signs. To stupid is strong with these ones. So in many ways, therein lies the rub, I suppose. The American people know they're getting screwed, and they have no idea how to get unscrewed. Hint, turn, if you want to unscrew something, turn left. Eh? Barbie with a note. She says, Bob, it's so bad in our country that at my last job I had to bring back proof, a program from my uncle's funeral, in order to be paid. Doesn't that say it all? Well, yes, because, of course, that what otherwise that might affect your productivity numbers, Barbie. And productivity is everything. My old buddy Joe Vecchio, don't say productivity around him. Then he has to put his foot in the bucket and sing. Or just go off into paroxysms of rage about the theft of labor from the working class. Well, I really didn't mean to turn this into the entire filibuster, so that means we're going to have to extend it. Yeah, Jim with a note, he says, siesta. Noon to 4 p.m. I remember it well. Do you suppose if that notion had ever caught on here in the new United States of America, the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, you reckon we would just be laying around in economic malaise? Because I don't think so. And then But that's a question for us to ponder as a community. This being, after all, a safe space where we can talk about these things without having, you know, some birth or death or ninth or tenth or bagger booger eater birch or libertarian hollering, Benghazi! Thunk! How do you, in the face of Citizens United, how do we, under the barrage of constant billionaire-funded right-wing attack ads, how do we tell the American people that it's okay to stand up on their feet and say no, no more? We come first. We matter most. Because that's the essence of the argument. Who matters most, American corporations or American human beings? Maybe that's our failure in framing it, because people and persons, no, corporations are people too, my friend. Maybe it's the human beings versus the corporations. Because, well, I really would like to see the rats try to define a corporation as a human being. A little bit of hope. I had a note earlier today from Andy, our friend of long standing from out in California, formerly of New Jersey. And Andy directed my attention to some rather encouraging news. Here's a good way to unscrew something: by turning left. You may or may not have heard, but the Wisconsin Democratic Party had its convention this past weekend. And they had a straw poll there of people attending the Wisconsin Democratic Party convention. They asked, who would you like to have be your nominee for the presidency of the United States? Joe Biden, 16 delegates, or 3% of those attending, voted for Joe Biden. 16 delegates, or 3% of those attending, voted for Martin O'Malley. 19 delegates, or 4% of those attending, voted for other. 208 delegates, or 41% of those attending, said Bernie Sanders. Only 252, or 49%, said Hillary Clinton. I like those numbers. I'll take those odds. We can begin to unscrew our country. And it seems like 41% of the delegates attending the Wisconsin Democratic Party convention know how. Now, wouldn't I love to be a fly on the wall in the Clinton campaign headquarters? You think that number freaked them out a little bit? Probably not. They probably said, well, you know, there's a lot of really, really liberal people in Wisconsin that probably would go for Bernie. Mm-hmm. We don't have to worry about it, though. We've got the money. Madam Secretary, he's raising a lot of money, $5 at a time. What? From people who don't like the fact that you're taking money millions of dollars at a time from, you know, Wall Street. What? I'm not going to goon on Hillary. I'm not going to goon on Secretary Senator Clinton at all. I'll leave that to the left. What left? I'm going to go about the business of supporting Bernie Sanders through this long and tormented process. Thank you very kindly. The straw poll was conducted by WisPolitics.com. There were 511 delegates, alternates, and registered guests who voted in the straw poll. Here's an interesting thing, though. If you take the other and the Joe Biden and the O'Malley's, then it becomes 51% Bernie Sanders to 49% Hillary Clinton. 51% of the delegates, and this is the one where maybe there's a few drops of flop sweat popping at Team Hillary. 51% of the delegates voting in the Wisconsin Democratic Party convention straw poll said, no thanks, not her. And frankly, I think this will probably double down the Oppo research over there in the Clinton camp. Is they're going to have to come up with something better than a 40-year-old article Bernie wrote in an alternative newspaper that no longer exists to you know, beat him up with. The fact of the matter is, Bernie is talking about things that matter to America, no matter how much the for-profit media or how often the for-profit media hollers
Socialism! But he's a socialist. I mean, he wants everybody to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick, for Jesus' sakes. That ain't America! I mean, if everybody could go to the doctor when they're sick, we wouldn't be the greatest country in the world on earth now today forever no more.
But there's hope there. People turning out in droves to hear Bernie speak wherever he goes, and he's feeling froggy enough that he says, screw it. Let's get the debates going right now. And he says, you know, and let's make it fun. Did you catch this? Bernie says, let's start the debates now, and let's not just Democrats talk amongst yourselves and Republicans talk amongst yourselves. Bernie said, I want Ted Cruz. I want Scott Walker. Bring me Carly Farina. Bring me Marco Rubio. Bring me Pastor Brother Governor Diabetes Snake Oil Salesman Mike Huckstaby. Bring them to me. Feed me, Seymour. Wouldn't that be a delight? Of course, it will never happen because, well, Rince Priebus of the Royal Imodium Mounted Dragoons and his trusty possum Splat would never tolerate that. One wonders how Senator Clinton would handle it. Because, you know, the choice is pretty clear. We can sort of toddle along, trundle along, pocketa, 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 pocketa. As the bolts come loose on the hubs and the wheels fall off one by one on this crumbling empire. Or we can set about the business of fixing things and believing in America again. And I'm not talking about any of that shining city on a hill, morning in America, Ronald Reagan bullshit political ads. I'm talking about believing in an America that remains the only country to put a human being on the moon and once aspired to put human beings on Mars. An America that believed its president when its president said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, which was subsequently replaced during the reign of error of dim leader by, the only thing we have is fear. Get under the couch! So there's ever so much more, and we'll start the official part of More and Monday here in a few minutes. I'm going to take a wee tiny bit of a break. And we'll... Hey, where's Tim from L.A.? We'll fire up the Calliope. I love saying Calliope when I know Tim's listening. And again, we are trying to raise $150 more dollars for the evening's, the evening fundraising goal. Doesn't matter how it comes in—a buck, $5, $10, $20, or $150, or well, you know, it doesn't matter. What matters for everybody who listens to this program is that it comes in. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
see what you can find. If a daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If a daddy's poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane, you a down or a turn of 25. When the sun goes down, you can make it good and live by. We love people, we love daddy, we love mean. We love everybody, but we do as we please. When the weather's fine, we go fishing or go sailing in the sea. We're always happy, lives we're living, yeah, that's our philosophy.
You can take her for a meal. If your daddy's poor, you can do just what you feel. Hongo Jerry, a British band in the early 70s, in the summertime. Probably a little bit of a snide reflection on the class-based society in the UK at the time, but by God, don't it translate to 2015? Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed. We'll fire up the Calliope in a minute. For now, though, let's run over on the stress line, 304-663-4676, and talk to Jim in Louisiana, Stan. What do you say, Jim?
Not much, Bobby. You got my my 50.
It did roll in, and I thank you very kindly.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. I'm really impressed by the way, you know, how Bernie's doing. He's doing really well, especially with all the passive aggressive negativity going toward him. You know what I mean?
Well, he's got no friends in the for profit media. That's for sure, Jim. But remember, Team Hillary hasn't turned their big guns on him yet. Because the goal there of Team Hillary is to spend as little money as possible running up to the primaries, and because she wants to save her war chest for what she presumes will be her nomination to defend in the general.
Right, and keep her powder dry.
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know who the Republican. You think it's going to be Bush? I can't imagine.
I got no. I still got a thin on Scott Walker because he's got the Koch brothers money behind him. He is. I mean, he's dumber than a hollered out stump, but he's got the Koch brothers money behind him. And well, some 15 years ago, Jim, we might recall that having a whole lot of money and being dumber than a hollered out stump was a pretty good combination for getting to be president.
Yeah, funny how that works out that way. Well, see, the thing to me, and I understand people work and have jobs, and even if they don't have jobs or you know, they're stressing out, how anybody can vote for a Republican who isn't making over $200K a year is beyond me, or even $100K, $150K. That's just, you know, mind-boggling to me. I mean, and then how they want to just cut quote-unquote social programs. And even, you know, even if you work at a grocery store or something, when they cut those food stamps or welfare, that means less money's coming into your store, you know?
Sure it does, but so far, Wally World isn't hurting, and that means they haven't picked up the phone in Bentonville to straighten up their bought and paid for politicians.
So I understand the rotten politicians, but the people, how easily they're manipulated. Like I've told you before, it's, you know, my family's quite a sight. I mean, it's like me and my youngest brother, about the only key. You know, I'm the leftist, and he's a Democrat. Everybody else is kind of like, you know, Republican Central, even though I could point out things to them. But even when you point things out to them, they ignore it. It doesn't make, you know, they don't want to believe it. It's almost like a religious cult. It is a religious cult. The Republican Party is a religious cult. You know, in my esteem.
It's a religious cult, Jim. It's an economic cult. It's a social cult. It's a cult.
Yeah, but even in that,
and it's also cult. And what's more than that, it is a minority religious. I mean, it is a minority political party. The people who are rock ribbed straight ticket voting Republicans are a very pale minority in this country. And that's, you know, that's how we come back to the question of how do we unscrew America. See, it's the way that they manipulate the balloting, which is, of course, in turn, Stalinist. And I don't care how many people vote. I care who counts the votes.
Yeah. Well, we saw that in 2000 and 2004. And who knows what other elections on top of that, you know? I mean, and for the Democrats to just sit idly by and let that crap go down like that, of course, they don't want to spoil shit, you know, because it's either them or the Republicans, and I guess they figured if they stirred up too much of a stink, they might throw a lot of them out. I mean, is that, do you think they ended up doing? Just deciding, okay, well, we'll just, you know, and they did it twice, 2000, 2004. And we got the worst, I swear Bush has to be the worst freaking president. We had Bush too. Worst freaking president we had.
I mean,
do you think?
Hold on there. Because his awfulness was awful during my early beginnings of what is called middle age, or, you know, the end of my, you know, the beginning, the end of my 30s, the beginnings of my 40s, and therefore it's all very fresh and all very. But I'm not just going to hand the worst president ever crown to George W. Bush. I'm not going to do it. Because Ronald Wilson Reagan, 666, Ronald Wilson Reagan worked too damned hard to be the worst president in American history, just to be blown off. And as I was noting earlier, Jim, look, most everything that we find odious and noxious and leading to the great coming apart of the American experience, it doesn't trace back to George W. Bush. It traces back to Ronald Wilson Reagan, Dutch, the
right.
Gipper.
Right. Yeah, that was the first time I ended up for Anderson, because I was down in Louisiana stand, so my vote wouldn't have mattered one way or the other.
I've gotten to the point where I can't even think about the Bush presidency without wondering if I'm not actually talking about the Cheney presidency. And frankly, I'm not much wondering anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like in 2000, I voted for Nader because I was living in Nevada, and I figured it's kind of a protest vote, and what's his name is not going to win Nevada. So I did that. But, I mean, like in 2016, I hope Bernie gets in here. I don't know. I know he's not going to go as a third party, which is pretty smart. And even then, it's going to be close. I mean, I don't know.
Well, you mentioned Nader. Listen, after the 2000 election, I did not hold 2000 against Ralph Nader. I don't hold that against Ralph Nader. But I'll tell you this, Jim. He is working overtime to make himself odious and despicable lately. Now, like I said, I'm not gonna sit here and goon on Senator Secretary Clinton because, well, on her worst day, she would be better than anybody running on the Republican side. And I realize there are people That somewhere out there, somebody on the alleged far left, what left, has just, you know, had a mini stroke and going, but, Brooklyn, Hillary Brooklyn. But I'm not going to do that. But I saw some remark earlier today where, Ralphie has declared that Hillary is compensating for her gender by being more militaristic. And as someone who considers himself a feminist, that really pissed me off.
Now, who said that? Nader?
Nader!
It's
Pantsuits Part 2. I mean, can Hillary not have a political position, Jim, that isn't somehow inextricably intertwined with her vagina?
I would say.
I mean, when was the last time that a male candidate running for president who, Bernie wants to rebuild the middle class. Bernie wants to strengthen Social Security. Has Ralphie come out yet and said that Bernie is compensating for his gender by wanting to feed more babies instead of bomb them?
No.
But Ralphie really lost me with the suggestion that, well, you know, maybe liberals can get together behind that fine young fellow Rand Paul and break the corporate state.
Yeah, I heard that crap. I couldn't believe that. I mean, Rand Paul, I mean, he's kind of like a broken clock. You know, he's right about twice a day out of 1,440 times.
But this isn't even a Rand Paul thing. I mean, I wouldn't pee on Rand Paul if he was on fire. But,
right.
No, this is a Ralph Nader thing. And what bothers me and what disturbs me and what, frankly, scares me is that there are a whole lot of progressive people who listen to Ralph and say, golly, he says a lot of the right stuff. And you know what? In the past, he has. And his positions on the corporate state are not wrong. But for some reason or another, he's lost his ever-loving mind.
Right. Well,
telling progressives to make that Rand Paul might be their guy?
What? Because Rand Paul might let people smoke dope? Well, Rand Paul's not going to be in the national legislature anymore, Jim. If he wins, he'd be president. And he can't pass legislation to let everybody smoke the marijuanas.
Yeah. No. And I did like that, what you said earlier about the human being versus the corporations. That's definitely what it's down to. I mean, it's been like that forever, almost, as far as I can see. But it's so blatantly obvious that you can't really even explain that. Yeah, to must be even people within the machine. They don't want to. If you're in a non-union shop and you try to bring up the union, good luck. It's scary, but I'm really impressed. I mean, Bernie, what's the story on Hillary that you know? I mean, are her gatherings as enthusiastic and charged as Bernie's? I mean, I haven't seen them, all of Bernie's. I get off, the internet. But he's really, catching fire. He's doing well in a good way. Is that what you gather?
I don't know. I mean, frankly, apart from, and I give credit where credit's due. What she did down in Texas was good.
Yeah.
Talking about voter suppression, and she's able to do it because she has the war chest to do that. Bernie doesn't have the money to hire those kind of lawyers. You know, the really nasty, mean litigators who will challenge these voter ID laws. And challenge disenfranchisement. Good for her that she's doing it. And you know what? If it wins her some votes, that doesn't mean she's the devil, hardcore left. That means she's good at politics.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, do you think, somehow, let's suppose she wins the nomination, and do you think she'll just go back to the right, or maybe state keep some of her quote unquote left leaning learning bits?
No, I think it's very difficult to say. We may get her policy positions are not mirror image, are not clones of Bill's policy positions. I mean, I think we'll know a lot when she finally opens up about TPP, for instance.
That she's keeping that close to her vest. Yeah.
Well, right now there's it's going to be a matter. See how the polling goes. How does the polling go? You know, with any luck at all, the best alternative for Hillary would be for TPP to pass and just be a non-issue, and her never to have to say anything about it. Remember, that was kind of the approach that Barack Obama took to the Keystone XL pipeline until it became obvious that they were going to force his hand and make him say something.
Yeah, it's not pretty, man. It's not pretty. All right, well, I'm going to let you go. Let's talk to somebody else, and hopefully somebody else will throw in a little something through the show.
All right. Well, Jim, you have yourself a good evening. I've got a buddy who's down in New Orleans right now. His wife's on a seminar, and he said, "Man, I'm going to have a lot of free time to see New Orleans. Any suggestions?"
I like an Irish pub on Decatur, right down the block from the House of Blues, Ryan's Irish Pub. I think it's still there. I haven't been in New Orleans in a... Yeah, it's still there, I'm sure. Ryan's Irish Pub, about a block and a half off of, a block or two off of, Canal. Not that I've been there much.
Right. Never. Well, I've sent him to Central Grocery for a muffaletta and a couple other places I knew of, and I'll mention Ryan's Irish Pub to him.
All right.
All right, Jim. You have a good evening, and thanks again for the help over the weekend.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim, calling from Louisiana, Stan. And I'll go ahead and I haven't played the Calliope music yet. I have to say that again because I know Tim's in the room now. But I'll go ahead and open the phone lines too, of course. The stress line, 304-663-4676, 304-663-HORN, or the other line, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178. We used to call that the Skype line, but it confuses people, so we'll just call it the other line. It just got a from Tim from LA. Oh, shut up, Bob. Calliope. Yeah. Y'all, we'll just dispense with the Calliope this week and get back to it next week. Seems like if it doesn't happen at the top of the program, it somehow just doesn't really work. Let's try the other line that's the Skype line, but we won't call it that.
Thank you.
Is that you, Jim? Hey, Jim.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm among the living. How about you?
Glad you had a real good weekend with your daughter and her celebration.
Oh, we did, Jim, and now we're just recovering.
Well, I wish her the greatest success in her pursuit and the field of nursing. God knows we need good nurses and things like that. That's for sure.
Well, I think she'll be a good one if she's got an opportunity to pursue it pretty much as far as she wants to go with it.
Noble ambition, worthy cause.
Hear, hear. And from a purely self-interested point of view, a field that is never going, it's going to continue to be a growth field in this country for quite some time.
Oh, no doubt. Particularly the way the medical profession in this country is going. But nonetheless, I hope she will find it rewarding and very, very, oh God, what can you say about nurses? Is there adjuncts to doctors and things like that in patient care?
That's the thing, Jim. So much of medical care has changed so dramatically.
Horribly.
Well, horribly. Yeah, I was going to say, and I don't necessarily know for the good. But, and it's all, you know, it's all Harvard MBA stuff, too. It's about maximizing productivity and profit making. Because the way it was explained to me, she's starting out on the lowest end of the healthcare totem pole, or she's starting out at the lowest end of the the caregiving.
She has a long road to hoe, Bob.
She does. But the thing is, CNAs in 2015, certified nursing assistants, do what LPNs used to do, licensed practical nurses.
Right.
In 2015, licensed practical nurses do what RNs used to do. And RNs, the way it has been explained to me, are doing most of the record keeping and the paperwork, whereas like actual care delivery, not so much. And right now she's at a point, Doodle's at a point in her life where she wants to be hands-on caregiving.
Well, I can remember when I have several doctors in my family, and each of them, when they, you know, began their residencies and things of that nature, they detailed them to empty bed cans or bedpans, whatever, the lowest of the low, and then to really see exactly what the whole healthcare structure envisioned as far as patient care.
I don't know. I don't know if that's still the case.
No, it's not.
Because one of the things that I do know, and I've mentioned this on a number of occasions, I can't remember the last time that I went for a general go to the doctor, I've got a cough, I've got a cold kind of thing, and saw an actual MD or DO. I see a certified nurse practitioner.
Well, you know, I can.
But my healthcare provider still gets billed for an office visit.
Of course.
See that's how the economics work? Perfect. The doctor doesn't even have to be there, but the provider gets billed for a doctor's office call.
Exactly. I mean,
meanwhile, since there's no since I don't see a doctor, and I see a certified nurse practitioner instead, they bill for the office call, and that puts a cushion in between what they the considerably smaller amount of money they pay for the certified nurse practitioner and the larger amount of money that they would have to pay the doctor. And meanwhile, the doctor sits over in Summersville and does a weekly review of, you know, maybe the charts.
Maybe the chart. Right. Exactly. But nonetheless, the medical healthcare system in this country has been so degraded, and there is so much of the lack of compassionate care that it's not to be believed. That's for sure. And, you know, I think we both agree on that. But one thing I wanted to bring up, I was watching the Smithsonian Channel, and they had this whole thing in the weekend about the 50 states, and they came to West Virginia. Now, I've not been traveling in your area of the world, okay, or mm-hmm. West Virginia. But when I saw about mountaintop removal, and the moonscape that it has become, I saw one mountain that was left. On top of it was a cemetery with a few trees around it.
Yeah, that's Cayford.
My God, I couldn't believe it.
And everything for miles around has been just blown away.
I mean, it's like moonscape, as I said before, and it's just, it's totally unconscionable. It certainly is.
And you might find this interesting because, you know, you and I over the years have gone round and round over issues religious. But this is,
oh, yeah.
But this is one where I think you and I will come to patent agreement, because this is kind of a big deal. Are you familiar with a publication called the National Catholic Reporter?
No, I'm not.
It's a widely read publication, and it is an official publication of the church. Today, we didn't ask for this to be done. It was done because it's right. The National Catholic Reporter, I don't know if it may not be an official arm of the church.
I'm not sure, Bob.
But it's called the National Catholic Reporter, the independent news source. A writer by the name of Tony Magliano, published there today an article called "The Hidden Poor of Appalachia," and it opens with a big horrifying shot of exactly that moonscape that you were describing, Cayford Mountain. You can find this at NCR, people in the Horn Family Commune congregation who want to run looking. NCR
okay.
Online, ncronline.org. It's under the blogs. The blog is titled Making a Difference, The Hidden Poor of Appalachia. Just listen for a second to what he had to say. Tony Magliano says, back in the mid-1980s, I was working as a director of religious education at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Western Maryland. That part of Maryland, like all of West Virginia and parts of 12 other U.S. eastern states from Alabama to New York, is part of the Appalachian Mountain region. In those days, as I got to know the beauty of Appalachia and some of the simple, friendly, and caring mountain folks, we'll take issue with that later, I discovered the grinding poverty many of them were experiencing. largely out of sight in the mountains and hollows were people living in shacks with no indoor plumbing. They would haul water from the nearest spring. Since there were very few jobs and inadequate public services, most of them were stuck in their poverty. I remember Judy, who helped with our special education Bible class the winter before we met. She and her family lived in a tent in the mountain woods. It's a miracle they survived. I remember Dagwood, an older man who cared for his two little granddaughters in a small rundown shack with a floor made of dirt and rotten wood. I remember a lady who was 80 years old. Habitat for Humanity volunteers built her an indoor toilet. Up to that point, she was using an outhouse. I remember the family that didn't even have an outhouse. Before Habitat built them one, they were using the woods. And I remember the coal companies. Their deep mining and mountaintop removal mining raped the land and polluted the air, rivers, and streams. Their blasting regularly damaged the houses of many already poor Appalachian residents, and sadly, these abuses continue to this day. You can help correct some of this injustice. Please urge your U.S. representative to co-sponsor the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, H.R. 912, which is designed to determine the health hazards of mountaintop removal coal mining and hopefully will lead to its end. And urge your two U.S. senators to introduce a companion bill in the Senate. And he also points out that the Catholic Committee of Appalachia has a lot more information about mountaintop removal.
Oh, they do.
And you know, the bishops come in for a lot of deserved criticism over their hooting and hollering about the workings of women's insides. But this one they get dead right. Tony Magliano or Magliano, I'm not sure, writes, the bishops wrote that the destructive growth patterns of corporate giants like the coal companies often pollute the air, foul the water, and rape the land. They declared the driving force behind this perversion. How about that? Referring to coal mining as perversion. The driving force behind this perversion is maximization of profit, a principle which too often converts itself into an idolatrous power. It delivers up control to a tiny minority whose values then shape our social structures. It has become clear to us that the present economic order does not care for its people. In fact, profit and people frequently are contradictory. Profit over people is an idol. This is not a problem only for mountain folk. It is everybody's problem.
Of course it is. Absolutely. I mean, you know, they're destroying people's not only their homes, but the whole, you know, environment of the earth. And do you think these people are going to actually come back and try to reforest, to replace, and to make whole that which they took away?
Of course not. One of the most stunning pieces of legislative legerdemain that you can witness is to see how quickly a coal company closes down its mountaintop removal operation and how quickly then they are released from their reclamation bond. Because that's a lot of money.
Yes, it is. And I don't understand how they can legally do that. I mean, if they have a reclamation bond, which is seated in law, how can they not be held responsible for what they've done? Unless, of course, they know ahead of time they will never have to do it.
Well, that's you have answered your own question, Jim.
And all they have to do is simply leave it and leave you where I found you. It's just incredible. But I'll tell you, the Smithsonian Channel did have a good thing about mountaintop removal and the destruction and the horror that you've been talking about for a long time. And I was very moved by what I saw. I mean, I don't think I've seen destruction like that ever since a world war.
And the funny thing is, a lot of West Virginians haven't either. A lot of other West Virginians. You have to go out of your way to really see it. And most of the time, it's in the company of some flack from what, well, see, I know this phrase is not lost on you, Jim. You know what a Potemkin village is.
I do.
So, the coal companies spent millions upon millions upon millions of dollars, reclaiming a particular mountaintop removal site. And they, you know, they still can't get it to grow a tree, but, you know, there's grass on it, and they've imported some turkeys, and you might see a butterfly once in a while, and maybe there's a, you know, some little newt in a stream gasping for its last breath.
And these things will last as long as these people are there for their visit to the Tsar, so to speak.
Exactly. It's a Potemkin village, because that's where they take, that's where the coal companies take friendly politicians to say, see, we made it better than God did. Look at all our reclamation. Look at that babbling little stream there. Isn't that lovely? That, see, we reclaim all this.
I don't know what they're doing. Well, I can tell you what I think they're doing. They are trying to cover up what I consider to be rape.
Yeah. These need to be understood as crimes. If you did mountaintop removal near some Tony section of touristy Colorado, if you tried to do mountaintop removal in the mountains of Washington or Oregon, there would be hell to pay.
Well, this state has very little representation. They are considered a backwater in which nobody really cares about. The only thing you hear about West Virginia, as far as the public is concerned, are the beautiful mountains, the Greenbrier. Let's see what else. Well, obviously you've...
Pearl Buck. You know, don't forget Pearl Buck.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
In the last few decades, what's his name from Rocket Boys? You know, October Sky, Homer Hickam.
Oh yeah, the guy who worked with Werner von Braun.
Chuck Yeager, Jerry West.
Yeah, I noticed on this particular program there was one guy who stayed where he was and refused to give up and was offered $2 million.
Mm-hmm. He's dead now.
Yeah, $2 million to give up his home and this, that, and the other, and he refused to.
And he's dead now.
And I thought that, well...
Not of natural causes, okay? I mean, you live next door to it long enough, it's going to kill you.
But when you look at the beauty and the scenery that was once there before and the attachment people had to the land, I mean, they've been there for like two centuries at least. And to have it taken away by people who were boondoggled into giving up mineral rights and things of that nature. And you and I have talked about this before, and it's one of the many things upon which we have agreed. It's absolutely criminal.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you said West Virginia. You said a few minutes ago West Virginia has very little representation in Washington. Jim, I would disagree with you only insofar as I would say West Virginia has no representation in Washington, because the people sent from West Virginia to Washington are there for one thing and one thing only, to represent the coal companies and the gas companies now.
And, of course, they tried to offset this in the things that have been sent into West Virginia. For example, the radio free area in which there's a huge radio telescope. And some other things that have been put here. But it doesn't account for the horror and the absolute destruction of not only a people's way of life, but also the destruction of the earth with no compensation whatsoever. They always get away with it. Let me ask you something.
Sure.
What do you think, and I'm not trying to be provocative here, about Mr. Blankenship and his business here?
Well, I think he's a psychopath myself. And if you ever get anywhere near him and get to look in those, look into those rat-like, beady little eyes, you'll find that it's like staring into the abyss. There's
dead eyes.
There's no humanity behind them.
You know, I looked at him very carefully in this documentary, and looking into his eyes, and the eyes to me are the windows of the soul. He has no soul.
Well, and of course his trial is coming up this next month, unless he gets it continued again.
Well, who knows about that? He's been trying to go to Las Vegas. He's been trying to go to this, that, and the other. I think they allow him to go to a limited area or whatever. But I do believe that what they're trying to do is to extend his legal problems into a new administration and to a new...
I think if he's convicted, his appeal might extend that far. But I don't think he can push. I don't think he can push the trial out to past January 20th, 2017, Jim.
Well, I hope not, and I hope this man will be brought to account for what he's done.
Well, that's the thing, though.
Or he didn't do.
If he is convicted on every count, it must be understood that none of those counts will take into account the fact that he through his dealings had 29 people incinerated past being recognizable as human beings.
Or it goes back further than that, Bob. I mean, this program, for example, went back to one incident of mine disaster in which 300 and some people were killed.
That's not Blankenship.
No, this isn't Blankenship. But, I mean, there's a history of this. And I think people have become so inured to that type of thing because, well, you know, mining and this, that, and the other, it's a dangerous thing.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what CNN, they stuck a camera in the face of a brand new widow after Upper Big Branch, and she said, well, we always knowed mining was dangerous.
Well, that's true.
But it doesn't have to be as dangerous as Blankenship made it.
No. And they don't have to treat people like cattle or serfs and this, that, and the other.
But by the same token, let's remember the miners that Don Blankenship, and this is a worthy topic. Don Blankenship made his bones by busting the UMWA, and the UMWA was absolutely incompetent to oppose him. They didn't have the leadership. And
yeah, John L. Lewis had long passed over.
Exactly. And Cecil Roberts is not fit to carry John L. Lewis's sweat socks.
Right.
But what happened is the UMWA, he crushed the UMWA, but part of the way he did it was to say, listen, you don't need a union in order to be paid $80,000 a year for mining coal. I'm happy to do that.
That was a grievous error.
And so you could actually, if the folks I know who tell me these things are telling me square, you know, you could work for Massey and make more as a non-union Massey coal miner than you could working at a union hole.
Well, you know, they've always been behind the elimination and destruction of any type of collective bargaining, and they will basically tie that to some type of salary thing, which can be changed in the moment of the lie, and it means nothing. You know? You don't have any guarantee under this new system.
No. Do you remember, Jim, when, and this was right as Dim Leader was beginning the reign of error. All those Enron employees had all that Enron stock.
Oh, my God.
And they were all going to be millionaires, right? Because they had...
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then Enron just screwed them. And all of a sudden, those pensions and those retirement accounts... Well, they weren't really pensions. Well, yeah, they became... they became Confederate bonds. Worthless.
Yeah, they did.
Well,
I will never forget. Some guy put on the internet a host of union employees or Enron employees, and what it was, I don't know how they had managed to gather all these people, but they were out running naked with nothing.
Oh, the reason I mentioned Enron is because part of the deal of working for Massey was profit sharing.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Now when coal was selling, well, when Massey stock was selling at, you know, near $100 a share, that profit sharing looked pretty good. Now that Alpha Natural Resources, who absorbed Massey, is trading at 70 cents a share, that's not much in the way of a retirement now, is it?
No, it's not. Absolutely. And it's a presentment of things to come. You know, I was looking at a documentary in which this lady in Germany, before, you know, you could get out of Germany in the 30s, named Bello Fromm, who was a Berlin paper socialite, correspondent, and she was leaving. Had to pay the next year's tax before she left, even though she hadn't earned it. But she said, I'll never forget these words. She said, you know, this is a place to leave, even if you have to leave naked.
That's trenchant, Jim, because since I had family in from out of state, and my sister grew up here before the whole family moved to Alabama. So, you know, this is home-ish to her. You know, this is the home dirt. I was just trying to, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't being overtly political or anything like that. And I was trying decidedly to not be political. Have you ever had one of those conversations with somebody who's very close to you where you're able to crystallize ideas that you hadn't previously been able to give voice to?
I have.
Well, that's what happened here as I talked to my sister. And I explained to her, because we were talking about Doodle's future. I said, I love my daughter like I love breathing. But it is my hope that she will do well enough that she can get her education, get her RN, maybe even get a master's, do whatever it is she wants to do, and get as far away from this place as is humanly possible.
Understood. You're right. Absolutely.
Because what I said to my sister was, and tell me if I've got the time frame wrong, Jim. I mean, you live here. You know what this culture is. Tell me if I've got the time frame wrong. Inside of 10 years in West Virginia, it's going to get really bad. Inside of 10 years inside Central Appalachia, it's going to get really bad. By 20 years, it's going to be 20 years from now, it's going to be Lord of the Flies.
Oh, Bob, there's no way that they can restore what they have made unwhole. Let's face it. And it's no great surprise to me that a majority of the males and females who are graduating from your daughter's high school are going into the military, because that's basically the only place they have to go. There are no jobs here. The jobs here that are whatever they are seasonal. They don't pay anything in order to sustain a person year to year. Not year to year. We're talking about day to day.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't eat year to year. They eat day to day.
Amen. I think that's tonight's, wait a minute. Yeah, one of those.
But I mean, you know, it's really dreadful that this could happen. And, you know, throughout this entire program, they went to other states in the union in which a similar thing is happening. And I can't remember all the things because, I mean, I watched 50 states in the whole weekend of the Smithsonian Channel. It was a very revealing thing to me. I mean, I traveled in many of these states when I was in federal service. And, of course, that was not my reason for being there. But I had no idea that, you know, the entire landscape and lifescape of these countries, and they are countries. Each state is a country to itself. I mean, look at America today. You know, had been so degraded.
Right. And that's why I've asked from time to time when people say, well, Bob, why don't you move? And I say, you know, where to? Where aren't they after whatever is left? And I swear one of these days we are yet going to have that bumper sticker printed, Jim. They want it all.
Ah, well understood. You know, I always try for every gift I've ever given at Christmas in the past 20 years to at least make it a gift from the Homer Laughlin Company in Newell.
Yeah.
Because I love Fiesta, and I think it's gorgeous stuff. It really is. And it has unique craftsmanship, color, everything about it. My sister had a birthday that was coming up, but I already sent her her birthday present early. And I put on the thing, and I sent her one of these red Fiesta cups, you know, the big kind you can put a bowl of chili in or whatever.
Yeah.
And with it, I put, you know, happy birthday, sis. If they're going to put any more candles on it, it's going to look like the burning of Atlanta by Sherman. Love you.
She's
your
got,
brother, Jim.
Yeah, she's got, hopefully she laughs and doesn't, you know, right.
Well, you know, I have a bizarre sense of humor, so why not? And so does she. Look, I'm going to let you go. You got other people who want to talk. You've got loads to lift, no time to drift. So I will ring off here, and thank you for taking my call, and congratulations again to your daughter, and may she really do well, and I'm sure she will.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very, very much indeed.
All right, buddy. Good night.
Good night. Our buddy Jim calling from not too awfully far away at all. No, you when you because they're ceremonial moments, they cause you to try to look down the tracks a little ways. A graduation does, and it's not pretty. The future of Central Appalachia. And the question becomes then, what's going to be done about it? And my answer offered in trepidation is probably nothing. Whatever so-called prosperity was brought here by the coal industry will disappear. And all those good jobs will disappear with them. And the coal barons will go and take their money elsewhere. And, I don't know, 100 years down the line, some child of privilege will be entering Harvard or Yale on family legacy money that is absolutely soaked in Appalachian blood. And she'll never even know it, and she'll think that great-grandpappy was such a visionary. Yeah. Let's run back over to the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Bob. It's Diane.
Well, hey, Diane. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine, and you are a visionary.
I don't think so.
Yeah. If
I was a visionary, my children would have trust funds.
Well, I don't know if that has anything to do with being a visionary, but, yeah, it's, it, I hear you when you say, like, where would you move? Because I think many of us go through that kind of calculation. Although I'm not sitting in a state where they're blowing up the prairie.
Well, no, they've just managed to suck all the water out from under it. That's all.
Well, they're considering in the House and Senate, they're trying to consider a long range water plan, because some people here are sensitive to the concept of a long range water plan, but they're so tied up in the drama of not being able to fund the state, which is why I called in, because I want to report on a whole passel of morons, because I've had a front row seat to it, so to speak, this weekend with the Kansas House and Senate in overtime sessions. I know that's hit national news because New York Times reported on it a couple days ago, but the front row seat I'm talking about is that every day we at Kansas State University would get an email newsletter kind of message from the president keeping us abreast on the expected furloughs. And so it was like high drama here for at least 3 days, with at least 24,000 state employees who would have been considered non-essential being furloughed, including at the state universities. So it was just like and I'm not talking about me. That these kind of furloughs don't have anything to do with my position. Thank God, you know. But they have, 24,000 Kansans had to worry about it. And, of course, we all turn to them to do necessary work. So it really does affect everyone. So I nominate the Kansas State House and Senate and Governor as morons on, you know.
More in Monday, absolutely.
More. I mean, it was just like
and all the business with what foods the poor's can't eat. That's a done deal now, right?
Oh, the debit card or credit card, that thing.
Yeah,
I don't understand that.
No canned tuna for you, Jayhawker poor's.
Yeah, this state has really. I remember my friend who used to be a reporter for the Topeka Capital Journal. I remember once he said, well, if Brownback is elected, it'll go downhill real quickly, real quickly. And it has been like watching a slow motion kind of disaster. But here's what happened. The House and Senate had until 11:59 p.m. on Saturday to pass a budget, or 24,000 non-essential workers would be furloughed, and that's why we were getting emails from our president, and our president was clearly annoyed at being in the position of picking who was non-essential. You know, I mean, think about that.
Well, I think that would rise to a level well past annoyed to being.
Well, he was, but he was being professional. And, you know, there's a kind of fallout from this I expect to come. I mean, we have a really cool engineer, professor, president, and his wife is an engineering professor. And they're both real can-do type people and pragmatic, and they've really elevated the place. And they have more goals for Kansas State that they want to meet, but who's to say we can retain quality administrators like that when instead of doing, you know, the kind of things a president of a major land-grant university would want to do, he's dealing with these kind of problems. And the message I got from him, it was, I guess it was today, and I mean thousands of us got this message, all of K-State got this message. He's like, the past week has been exasperating and Yeah, I mean, he was professional, but he was basically saying what we all knew to be true. And this is the thing about these Republicans. They, it's cost them so far, it's cost taxpayers so far $40,000 extra dollars for them to be in overtime session. I mean, so, you know, we have $400 million some dollars in deficit, and then on top of that, every day they're in session overtime costs a lot of money. And Kansas City Star and Wichita Eagle, they're both papers are reporting it to be $40,000 overtime as of today. And so I was reading about what the Republican posturing was all about. And the guy, you know, these Republicans, they really look awful. I'm really fortunate to work with some really nice CEOs. I mean, maybe it's not considered politic for me to say that on your program, but I do. I work with some really nice people from the business sector, and they don't look or act the way these Republicans look and act. These Republicans in Kansas look like agents, you know, rubbery looking. And so the guy who's chair of the budget committee or whatever it's called, he came out in print and said, well, at the last minute, we voted to pass legislation to consider all Kansas employees essential so that no one can be furloughed. He said, we did that because it would look bad if people were furloughed due to our inaction. You know, Bob, I thought, oh, well, it would be much better if due to your action, while you take the knife and cut people's throat with the rusty blade, you know, it would be much better then, the corollary is, it would be much better if due to your action, they know they're furloughed. Do you see what I mean?
I do. I do, indeed.
So no one can be furloughed, but they still haven't passed a budget so that anyone can be paid. I mean, so this is a high drama we've been going through for the last, you know, well, we've been getting.
But let's be clear, Diane, this is high drama that has been absolutely unnecessary.
Oh, it's, you know, what keeps running
drama by intent. It's intentional drama. It's the destruction of state government for the sake of being able to say that state government doesn't work.
Well, it's self-inflicted, and now Brownback is considering some revenue sources. So, I mean, I'm not praising him for that, but they are considering some taxation besides the sales tax. They want to do a huge increase in sales tax and cigarette tax
regressive taxation.
Right, naturally regressive. But I'd like to dig up John Maynard Keynes and trot him out and just let him loose on them because they're being ridiculous. But the thing is, they can't, what we're hearing through the news, and, you know, we have our public affairs specialist up there, the university does. So we're hearing that the Republicans are just deeply divided on whether to raise revenue or not. So we've elected, I didn't elect any, I didn't vote for any of them. I mean, we have a representative here she's Democratic, and I voted for her. She's a representative of the 66th district. But we have Kansans have elected Republicans who cannot govern. They just simply cannot do it. And, you know, Brownback is, you know, it seems like he's widely hated, but that's just the impression I'm getting from living in this university community where
yeah,
we're...
Yeah, that may be a little bit of bubble-itis.
Right, bubble. You know, because I kind of have a charmed life here. I just, every day I walk in the Central Park before this time, you know, like I just basically came back from walking in the park. And it seems like when I'm walking in the park, I literally feel like I'm in a Norman Rockwell painting. Seriously. You know, because everyone's out walking their dogs, and there's some band at the pavilion, and the tennis courts are full, and, you know, it's just idyllic. And yet this wider drama is playing out. Although there was this little scene while I was in this Rockwell painting on Friday, I was sitting near the tennis courts podcasting your show. My favorite one lately is on the 28th with Angry Indian calling in. Oh my God, that was so good.
That was a magnificent, that was just,
that was a
big powerful conversation.
Oh, it was wonderful. So I repodcasted that one, and I think I was sitting there listening to it. So the band in the pavilion started to play the Star Spangled Banner, and the people who were walking towards the pavilion on the little side street in what we call Central Park, because it's the little apple here.
Yeah, right.
They stopped, and they all put their hand over their heart. You know, so I was sitting on the bench, surrounded by people who were either standing in the space in front of the pavilion with their hands over their heart, or the people walking towards the pavilion stopped in the middle of the street and had their hands over their heart. And I didn't. I was podcasting your show, sitting down just watching them. And I thought, you know, I had this kind of feeling of nostalgia, like, I think once I might have done that kind of thing, but I wouldn't dream of doing that kind of thing now.
Diane, my father, in any time there was a public live playing of the national anthem, my father teared up.
Well,
and he would take off that USS Essex hat that he had on his head and put it over his heart.
Well, and, you know, when my dad died 3 years ago, he had, what is it called, honor guard at his ceremony. The National Guard came with their bugle, and, I mean, because he's a vet, and he's... he was a pilot in World War II in the what was then called the Air Corps. And anyway, so we had the right to have an honor guard, and my mom arranged it. And so we were sitting with the casket under the big tapestry, you know, in where they buried him, and they folded, part of the ceremony is like how they fold the flag to guard, National Guard people are folding the flag, and there's a bugle, someone playing a bugle standing outside, you know, on the lawn. And so they folded the flag, and then one of them knelt in front of my mother and
presented
and
it
said,
to her,
on behalf of a grateful nation. And I, who had shed no tears, and I'm not prone to any emotional outbursts whatsoever.
Came right apart, didn't you?
I burst into tears. I lost it. I couldn't help it. I started sobbing, and my mom just looked at me and grabbed my knee and, you know, squeezed my arm. And she later had a craftsman make a wooden box, a triangular wooden box for the flag, to put that flag in. She put that flag in it. It has a glass case, and she presented it to me. And I didn't say anything to my mom. I could have, because she's a pretty cool woman.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, Paris. We'll always have Paris.
I was about to say the very thing.
But the reason I mean, as far as I can be in touch with my feelings at a time like that, it was because the country my dad loved so dearly and fought for and never talked about it was not the country that was, you know, there at the time of his death. I mean, I think that's where my grief was, because I'm not jingoistic, and I don't. You know, really
no,
care.
No. Well, I mean, I experienced much the same thing. I was the recipient of my father's flag.
Oh, really?
At his graveside ceremony.
Oh.
And because my mother was 10 years dead, and well, it was me. And I passed it over to Agnes, and it was and you know, the bugler was about 100 yards distant.
Yeah.
And it'll tear you to pieces.
Playing cats.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm looking at a picture of that bugler, and it's on the wall in my kitchen right now, and he's under some kind of one of those trees in Kansas that turns purple in the spring. So you were very touched by that moment as well.
Absolutely. I think you would, I think you would have to be dead of heart and spirit not to. Because that's, you know, that's not about jingoism.
No.
That is about reflecting for a moment on the very real sacrifices made.
Yeah.
We have two such flags in our house now. My father's from a few years back, and my Uncle Fred's from 1944. It has 48 stars on it, that flag does.
1944. Uh-huh. Hawaii wasn't a state yet.
Nor was Alaska.
Alaska, uh-huh, yeah.
We have his posthumously awarded Purple Heart citation.
Oh.
Signed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We have his Purple Heart. But the thing is, you know, where I perceive that you're going with all of this is that because, and this is my only way of explaining it, and you are, of course, much more marvelously coherent than I.
Oh, no, you're too kind.
But just as it is with that urine-colored snake flag that the right wing so adores to fly, they have made so many of the things that felt good and right about America, Diane, feel dirty and shameful and freighted with political poison. There was an honor guard with the flags and everything at the graduation ceremony Friday night. I stood up, I put my hand over my heart for the playing of the national anthem.
Uh-huh.
And then I just kind of, because everybody's supposed to be looking at the flag during the national anthem, right? And I just kind of furtively glanced around through the corner of my eye. And that gymnasium was doing everything but.
No.
And the little graduates were kind of tittering and elbowing each other, and you know, the eager young graduates that they were.
Uh-oh.
And then we got to the Pledge of Allegiance, and I was videoing, and I'm sure it can be heard. I haven't checked it yet, but you can hear me go through, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation,
blank, 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 mm-hmm,
with liberty and justice for all."
Yep. Yeah.
Because I won't say it.
It wasn't in the original pledge anyway.
No. I will not include something that was only foisted upon the American people by a bunch of anti-communist right-wing paranoids, Diane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I can get, I mean, I remember getting misty-eyed at Mountaineer football games when that big old West Virginia University marching band marches out on the field and forms the outline of the state of West Virginia and proceeds to play the national anthem. It's pretty moving. And within the meanings of symbolics, it's supposed to be.
Yeah, but you're saying that the crowd you were furtively observing wasn't into it at all.
No, they weren't. They weren't. They really, really weren't. And there were a lot of hats still on heads.
Oh.
And, I think that might be, a byproduct, Diane. Tell me if it sounds crazy. That might be a byproduct of oversaturation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Could be.
I mean, you know, we have to now. You know, at every big football game, we have to burn up a few hundred or thousand gallons of distilled hydrocarbons in order to fly our jet fighters, whose primary purpose now is to bomb to bomb brown people into their separated molecules. We have to fly them over the stadium, and then somebody who maybe next month will be dead in a misbegotten war in Afghanistan has to land on with a parachute. And then we turn loose an eagle to fly around.
The
symbol of the empire.
Oh, this is horrible. This is a nightmare you're describing.
Oh God, Diane, I didn't know. Okay,
I had no idea.
So I mean
it doesn't happen that way here.
Yes it does.
Well, how would I know?
As God is my witness, I'll bet you it does.
Well, the last game I went to, only because I was recognized on the field and because of something, a scholar thing, I felt like I had to be there. I was so uncomfortable. And before the president and provost honored a few of us that way, they had all these motorcycles come in and go round and round the track with the most horrid sound. And so the one game I've gone to here, I sort of had to, quite frankly, and they had all those motorcycles. Now that's not necessarily patriotic, is it? I mean, motorcycles.
Hey, but that's another thing.
Maybe they had flags on their handlebars.
A lot of Harley Davidson riders have been co-opted into the patriotic frenzy. That's one of the things you can. It's one of those telling things about rising fascism. The more fascist a country becomes, the more pageantry, the more reliance upon the patriotic motif. I got a homework assignment for you. Because I've never done this. I've never done this to somebody.
Well,
like
what makes you think I will?
Well,
let's hear it.
Okay. So this is June the 8th. Around July the 4th, we'll have to check and see exactly when. It comes Major League Baseball's All-Star break. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want you to try to make time to watch the All-Star game.
Oh, it ain't gonna happen.
You don't have to watch the whole game. I just want you to be there for the beginning of it on TV.
Oh. What channel is it on?
I don't know. We'll have to find out.
Oh, well.
Probably Fox.
Fox. Uh-huh.
But the thing is, at the beginning, it'll be, "And now, to honor America, please rise for the singing of our national anthem by hit country music recording star Billy Joe Bob Busted Knuckle."
Uh-huh.
And they'll march out with the honor guard, and there'll be a bunch of little children who spread out a giant American flag that extends the entirety of the outfield.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
And there'll be an honor guard with a member of the Marine Corps, the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. Maybe the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard gets left out a lot. And the Merchant Marine are never there.
Oh, that's a shame.
And they'll march the flag down, and then Billy Joe Bob Busted Knuckle will butcher the national, "Oh, say, can ye see?" And there'll be fireworks and maybe they'll let loose an eagle, and maybe there'll be jets or at least helicopters or at the very least a guy with a parachute.
I didn't know we'd come this far.
Yeah, the guy with the parachute will probably have red, white, and blue smoke trailing from smoke streamers attached to his body.
I may never get over it if I watch such a thing. I mean, that just sounds You know what? Remember after 9/11, I was telling people in this town, when the American flag was on cars, it was all over the downtown, you know, flags at every light or whatever. There's flags everywhere. And I was so annoyed. I try to edit myself when I speak to people, but I remember seeing the flag everywhere, and I just went into the post office one day. I said, "I need stamps, anything but that damn flag." I didn't like that because I was so annoyed because The flag was wet. It was left in the rain. It was on the ground. People were stepping on it. People had it on their cars and all kinds of weather. And I thought, this is, you know, I'm not that loyal, but if I'm going to have any feeling for the flag, it has to be on different terms. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I walked into a friend of mine has a shop downtown. I walked in. So what's the deal with all these damn flags? And that was at the height of all the, you know, and I knew better than to do that. But it was a small little shop, and she's a friend. She looked around and went, shh. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, no, it's this. It's come to this. Oh, no, shh. And, you know, she's a good friend. I just said, oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to. She didn't really have any clients in there, or I wouldn't have done that, but she thought some would come in, and I would say that again. And so it's kind of like what I've told people at the university. I don't want fascistic manipulations of my behavior through symbology. I don't want to see a disembodied cat, you know, the power cat, and the color purple, and then it's supposed to elicit some response from me. You know what I mean? I just can't do it.
But if you look at nationalistic states, Diane, you'll find that the more right-wing and more warlike they are, the more they rely on symbology.
Well, isn't that one? Who's that scholar who has those six? Who has written about those 16? I think it's 16 signifiers of fascism.
That's been going around. I'm not.
That's one of them.
That list rings as so true, but that thing originated over at a kind of a halfway cockamamie website called Rents.com.
Uh-huh.
And it refers to a professor whose work I have never been able to find.
Oh.
Because I went looking one time.
Uh-huh.
But the list itself makes eminently good sense. Let me see if I can find it here.
Yeah,
real quick.
The status of women is questioned. Maybe it's 13. I think it might be 16 things.
Let's see. Yeah, see, the very first place, it pops from Rents.com, and it's said to be by Dr. Lawrence Britt.
Huh, and you can't find him or her?
And I've never been able to find any sort of...
Well, now, this is a homework assignment I wouldn't mind taking on.
Maybe somebody in the chat room will tell me that Dr. Lawrence Britt is the noted emeritus chair of yada yada yada, but I've never found him. But the list makes sense. I mean, it's made only more sense in the years. I first read this in like 1999 or 2000. Powerful and continuing nationalism, disdain for the recognition of human rights, identification of enemy scapegoats as a unifying cause. Supremacy of the military, rampant sexism, controlled mass media, obsession with national security, religion and government intertwined, corporate power protected, labor power suppressed, disdain for intellectuals and the arts, obsession with crime and punishment, rampant cronyism and corruption, fraudulent election. And by the way, speaking of number 13 or number 12, obsession with crime and punishment, you know, you're not all that far from Nebraska.
Oh, I was so pleased to see. That's the only unicameral
legislature in the country. Right.
And they banned the death penalty, but not retroactively.
It's not retroactive, and that's where the gross part comes in, because Nebraska has this teabagger governor who has declared that it is his intent to, in the name of the state, murder all 10 of the people on Nebraska's death row before this law can take effect.
I hope it makes him happy. I mean, what's wrong with these people? I mean, I have to give it to Carol Abel and her understanding of phonerology. You know, that must be what we're talking about.
Well, this guy's very obviously a psychopath. This Nebraska governor, he's obviously a psychopath.
Yeah, and you know,
and because he's angry that anti-death penalty activists have succeeded in blocking access Nebraska, the governor's office proudly announced that they were pretty sure they had a line to the death-dealing drug from a company in India.
Oh, really?
And I mean, he has sworn, you know, as God is my witness, I'm going to kill all 10 of them if I have to strangle them myself.
Oh, my God.
Wrong accent, you know, but I think the intent is correct.
I don't know how they talk in Nebraska. It's a nice place, really. Have you ever been to Lincoln, Nebraska? I mean, it has its moments in Nebraska.
No, the only thing I know about Lincoln, Nebraska is from the football stadium. See, I'm simple and shallow that way.
Yeah, Cornhuskers or whatever.
Right, they used to be.
How I know that, I don't know.
Well, when they first started playing football, Diane, they were the Bug Eaters. They were the Bug Eaters. but no, a friend of mine moved from West Virginia to Nebraska and told me after his first football season out there that there is so much polyester, there is so much red polyester in that stadium that if one lit a match, the whole thing would go up like flash paper.
Well, why do they wear polyester? What's that about? I mean, the colors, they have their colors, but why polyester? Is he saying they're retro? Is that his way of saying they're just they're throwback?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, come to think of it, I meant to tell you, I got that from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania recently. Very recently.
Oh, did you?
Well, a couple weeks ago. And so, you know, how I feel about the Berg and you feel about the Berg. And it was really cool because I went there to, I'm starting a series of interviews of my mentor there. He's emeritus at the University of Pittsburgh. He's considered one of the main founders of corporate social responsibility. And he just turned 90 recently. So I'm learning Zoom technology. So I went there and convinced him to let me interview him in about 5 video clips on, the beginnings of CSR and on till now. And he's working on it. So I really wanted to get that record. I mean, he's published on it all over the place. But, I mean, I want to get it on video. I want him talking, you know. So I had a really nice dinner with him and his wife, who's a professor at CMU, and then just coincidentally my son was there. He lives in Rochester, New York, and he was in Pittsburgh just coincidentally, really, so I was able to meet up with him. But the Berg is benefiting from Google being there, I can tell you that.
Really?
Google's now there, and you see, I didn't know that.
No, that's a new one on me.
But if
I was Google, I wouldn't think twice about moving to Pittsburgh. I think Pittsburgh's
really. They're in. I don't know if you know where the Nabisco plant was. It was out east, and it was. Let's see. I lived in Shadyside, and so it was that big Nabisco. I remember when I first moved there, I was walking around Shadyside, and I'm like, the whole neighborhood smelled like chocolate chip cookies, and I'm like, what the?
Well, how charming.
I mean,
that's like downtown St. Louis used to smell like licorice because of the Switzer's factory.
I was like, it was just one of those things to discover about Pittsburgh. And then that someone told me, well, the wind's coming from the east and the Nabisco factory is over that way. You know, and so apparently Google kept most of the old brick, you know, it's like I would consider it a historic building at this point. And so Google's there, but now something else is going on there, Bob, that I heard about from 2 professors and then a couple other people. There's some big merger of 2 hospitals in Pittsburgh that is causing a lot of discord and locking some people out of the system and a lot of confusion, and which I hated to hear because, you know, health is what Pittsburgh has. You know, those hospitals.
Yeah.
So I'm not able to give more detail, but it's a big thing.
Well, depending on how successful it is, there is, and I had occasion to sort of investigate this a la carte, if you will, based on some things that happened recently. I climbed a short learning curve about real estate prices in the Bay Area. Not that I was thinking about moving or anything.
The Bay Area?
Yeah, San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, yeah.
Google is expanding so rapidly and so exponentially that the real estate market in the whole Bay Area has become, it's like you know what I'm talking about because the immediate place to think of is like, in America, Appalachia, the resource curse.
Oh yeah,
where people
you and Sandra talked about that a lot.
People with resources under the ground wind up being victimized by the people coming to get the resources. Well, it's almost like a variation on the resource curse. Real estate has become insanely impossible to get at because of the massive expansion of the tech boom in the Bay Area. And, you know, one wonders if the same thing will happen in Pittsburgh.
Well, I can report to you kind of from on the ground. I went over to my mentor's house. Now, I lived in Shadyside, and he and his wife lived, I mean, I could walk to their house when I was studying with him, when he was my dissertation chair, and so really close to my brownstone in Shadyside, and he and his wife said, well, Google's move's been good to us. They said our home's now worth $1 million. And I can tell you it wasn't that way. I mean, they live in a nice home in Squirrel Hill.
Oh, well,
you might
Squirrel
remember
Hill.
I mean, they have some nice big homes, but their home isn't that big. You know, and it's just like I thought, oh, I get it, you know.
Yeah.
Google has made that their property value rise a lot, so, yeah.
And inevitably, it's the you know, we've seen it. I got a quick course in it, and it was really sad when I went down to the South Georgia coast and found out, you know, what was happening to the old island communities there that were comprised by transgenerational inhabitants who were free, you know, descended from freed slaves. Well, the gentrifiers came in, and the real estate developers and the job creators.
Wow.
And what they did is when all those folks who had been living there for all those generations wouldn't sell out, they went to the county commission and made sure the property taxes got raised to the point that the people who lived there couldn't afford to pay them, and then just went in and stole the land from them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still going on. It was going on in the 20th century. It's going on in the 21st, Diane.
Well, it's, you know, it's that bumper sticker you keep talking about that we'll put on our cars. They want it all, right? I mean, yeah, and I think most of us are becoming more and more sensitive to the games played on the city level. I mean, I'm much more sensitive to it than I ever was before.
I think we would do well to remember that when the for-profit media talking heads are saying things like, it's great to live in our town, property values are increasing.
Uh-huh.
Well, that means that some poor family's going to take it in the shorts.
Well, truly, and... you know, I once stood up in front of a city council meeting here in Manhattan. They were developers were just drew a. I live by choice in an older part of the city because I want to live near the university, and I should have that kind of life. I feel if I wanted to live in a old bungalow and I can walk to my office and. You know, and when I first moved here, there was no problem with that. But then the city started expanding out, and, like, all the professors moved to the suburbs. I'm like, why? How boring. I mean, why have a city this size, and it has to go through that kind of development curve where everyone moves to the suburb? We have a nice, you know, city here with a, you know, historic downtown, historic park. I'm like, what's that about? Anyway, I didn't move. And then the developers got with the city commissioners and just drew a line all around my area and said, we want that for development. So I kind of got active and I got with the, what is it called? The League of Women Voters and the historic, society here and, a coalition of neighborhoods, and I wrote a letter to the editor, which was kind of passed around a lot. And then I went to the meetings, you know, so there would be a hearing about, you know, the activists who were questioning this plan and trying to thwart it, because, I mean, the room was full of people who had inherited their houses from their grandparents, and, you know, the house across the alley from me, when my elderly neighbor died, she died in the bed she was born in. So, I mean, this was a part of the city. There was still a lot of roots here. Well, I'm not proud of this or anything, but I went to the meeting, and one by one, people went up to the microphone, and the way the room was arranged, it still annoys me to talk about it, is that all the commissioners, who were all male at that time, one of my friends now is the mayor here, and there's three women on the commission, 3 out of 7, I guess, but at that time, it was all men, and I'm not saying they were bad people, but the way the room was arranged, they were on a lift, you know, they were like above us, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And so one by one, people would go to the microphone and say, well, dear sirs, dear commissioners, oh, and I thought, I got steamy every time someone spoke, like they were groveling in front of these people. There was like steam coming out of my ears. And now and then, someone made a good point, and I'd start clapping, and people all around me would go, we don't want to make them mad. And I was like, oh, my God. I just got madder and madder at everything. So I went up to the microphone, and I said, you know that you all are fascists. And then I went on to tell them the meaning, the technical meaning of fascist that I had in mind. And, of course, it was televised, whatever. And actually, we won. And not only that, but my street that I live on was actually circled in red and labeled the buffer street, meaning they weren't going to touch it.
Yeah, so come and call us fascists again. That was mean.
No, I'm not saying that that turned the tide. It was the fact that I was able to hook up with those other groups, but it just so happened that my street was the line in the sand, and I don't know if my street hadn't had a representative who did hook up with the, it's all about coalitions at that point, I'm not sure what would have happened to my street, because the developers wanted it, and they wanted it to put high rises, and they wanted the property, the elementary school, one of the elementary schools is a block down from me, and they wanted that, even so that property had been given to the county in perpetuity, you know, legally in perpetuity. And they lost that in court later anyway. But I'm just saying, I got a little bit of a front row seat to watch how these cities, you know, there are forces that want what they want, but I'd really try to edit myself, but you probably don't believe that now, because I just went up to the microphone and called all of them fascists. I didn't want to honor them with dear sir, or would you please.
No, you remind
the
me of...
The groveling was off the scale.
Oh, you do. You remind me, Diane, of something that happened a few years ago when I was invited to come to the... And I think maybe we've talked about this, and I know I've talked about it a number of times on the air, but I got a chance to go to the annual stockholders meeting for Bank of America.
In Scotland?
No, Bank of America.
Here.
Yeah,
okay.
In Charlotte, North Carolina.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and I got a and Brian something or another was the 33rd degree exalted noble Turk or whatever, the CEO, I don't know. And he sat there and he talked in his calm and dulcet tones and blah, and there were a lot of pissed off people in there because among other things they were pissed off about how Bank of America had behaved after it had been bailed out and how it behaved with regard to foreclosures, and we were there because they were a humongous financer of mountaintop removal.
Yeah.
And there were all these and there were all, you know, the silk stocking blaze ladies and the bespoke suited men sitting there looking ever so proper, and certainly ever so much better than we were. But, you know, I put on a suit and tie, you know, try to dress up a little bit, you know, behave like a halfway decent hillbilly. And so I too, like, and you reminded me of this when you were talking about all the people standing and say, yes, sir, no, sir, three
begging,
bags
like
full.
Begging.
Yeah.
Begging, as if they're lords of the manor and they just want pieces of bread.
And I think, I don't know, it may be out there on video somewhere, I'm not sure. It was...
Well,
it
was, mine was on TV.
It was a really creepy, creepy morning, because once we all got seated, the Bank of America knew what was coming, so every row had an armed to the teeth, plain clothes, off-duty Charlotte cop in it.
Oh, my God.
And there were people with assault weapons down both aisles of the auditorium.
What year was this?
2012. And so by the time my time came to speak, I just stood up, and instead of, you know, tugging my forelock and saying, begging your pardon, governor, I said, Brian, you're really upsetting me.
First name! Oh, I like it! Brian!
And I called him Brian every sentence. Because, see, Brian, I got people back. I got my friends and neighbors back home in West Virginia who sent me here to talk to you, Brian. And,
yeah.
Brian, you're participating in poisoning people. And so are you, ma'am. And so are you, mister. And so are you. And every member of your board has a hand in what goes on in funeral homes in West Virginia every day. And I want you to know that right now.
And what are
and I want it to trouble
to?
You in your sleep.
What did the armed thugs do as you spoke?
Oh, they were shifting their feet. You know, they were waiting for Brian to give him the high sign, you know, the lodge sign, you know, get him out of here.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I said,
"It's annoying when people are so when they defer to that."
Well, that was the fun part.
That
was the fun part, Diane. When I got done, I said, "And now, Brian, I'm done with you. I have nothing more to say to you. Good day." And turned and walked out of the room.
I love it because you were calling the time. You were in charge of. I like that you were in charge of the message, and you were in charge of when you were through giving the message. And you put a worm into his sleep pattern, probably.
Oh, I hope so. and they've made some steady progress on how they go about, you know, saying of it. They finally, I think, come around to saying, because Earth Justice, and Rainforest Action Network, have been after them for years, and they finally announced some policies this year saying they're getting completely out of the mountaintop removal financing business.
Well.
But it was kind of cute. There's a little bit of a denouement. One of my friends at RAN said that one of the organizers from one of the other groups that was pissed off in there turned to her and said, "Who the fuck was that?" and she's just a darling. And she turned to him, the beautiful redheaded woman, and she turned to him and said. And she's from the UK. And she says, "Oh, he's one of ours."
He's darling, Bob. To quote one of your recent missives.
Oh yeah, darling. I've never been darling.
Darling, Bob Kincaid. I remember you read that missive lately. Well, it's so nice when people are just real and don't. I mean, why defer to? That's not legitimate authority. I mean. It's that deference thing that gets me. I don't want to blindly defer. I mean, I dressed up for the city council meeting. I'm like you. I mean, I'm presentable. I'm not going to go up to the microphone and speak to them as if they are better than me.
And you know where that attitude on my part comes from? Two places, Diane.
Scotch.
No. It comes from, on the one hand, way, way, way back when John L. Lewis was still running the United Mine Workers of America, and this is a story my father used to tell me, he would show up at the contract negotiations with the Bituminous Coal Operators of America dressed better than the coal barons were. and they criticized him for it. I mean, we're talking about Savile Row bespoke suits, you know, cufflinks.
This is reverse symbology. This is great.
And he would, and they criticized him for it. And he said,
"Oh."
He said, "The rank and file of my union know that I need to be on an equal or better level than you because I am your equal and, in fact, probably better than you."
Yes, oh, it's a brilliant. It's brilliant that he did that, and also how petty of them to criticize him on that basis. I mean, I study the elites. They kind of make me ill sometimes, some of them.
Well, right. Well, because when they choose to favor that look, the elites can also adopt a sort of, what should we call it, Diane? A sort of manufactured slovenliness.
The status of, the reverse status of blue jeans or something like that.
Right. Remember the the preppy looks and.
I don't think Zevlin talked about blue jeans particularly, but it's that kind of thing. Now the blue jeans make a statement.
But the other thing I got it from was the civil rights struggle, and I got this sort of in reverse because, and this is going to sound elitist on my part. I don't mean for it to, but if you go and you study the civil rights movement, you'll note that every time, whether it was SNCC or SDS or Dr. King, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, not so much SDS, but like SNCC and SCLC, and even with Malcolm X, they always appear impeccably dressed.
A lot of them are probably church-going people,
because
too.
If you do not appear that way, then you start with one foot in the bucket because they dismiss you on account of your appearance. In the case of the civil rights struggle, they were starting with one foot in a bucket because of their appearance, because of their skin color.
So
they were not going to be any further dismissed. And so when the anti-mountaintop removal movement began to gain some steam, we had a lot of kids coming in here, white kids from privileged families, who wanted to do the hippie thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to engage in any hippie punching. I don't believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
But we tried to talk to them and say, listen, you're coming in here to a culture where people have been so dirt poor that all they had was their cleanliness.
Mm-hmm.
And they would no sooner go about dirty than they would eat shit.
Oh, my God, that's profound.
We may not have much, but we can at least be clean. As I've said before, my grandfather would not have crossed the threshold of my grandmother's home wearing the filth on him from the mines. He bathed at the bathhouse, and he bathed squeaky clean, and she washed his work clothes every damn night.
Yeah, real pride, yeah.
And they had that. And I remember the pushback we got, and I remember the indignation we got about how there was, well, you're just adopting the ways of the mon, dude.
Oh, uh-huh.
But I mean, it's been proven time and again. I think you could almost say it's one of those Saul Alinsky things, Diane.
Mm-hmm.
If you're gonna do battle, you gotta wear the right uniform. And that sounds really shallow, but never give power an opportunity. Never give power a freebie. A free opportunity to dismiss you based upon appearances or something like that. Speaking of symbology, I got to tell you before we get out of here, because we got just a little bit of time left remaining. Speaking of symbology, right. I got to tell you about. I got to go back to graduation.
Oh, Doodle's graduation.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
go Doodle.
So their high school mascot is the Raiders. Raiders,
mm-hmm.
right? They're Raiders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now, growing up in football culture, because I'm shallow, I think Raiders, and I think the side of the silver and black of the Oakland Raiders with the pirate with the knife clenched in his teeth and the patch over one eye and, yar, we're coming for you, right?
Oh.
Raiders, right? Predators. Well, no. These Raiders, their symbol is a medieval knight visage down over the helm, so he doesn't have a face, and he's holding in front of him a medieval shield with, I kid you not, a crusader cross on it.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
I mean,
do the kids know what that
is? I mean, if
is?
This was Saint Aloysius's. Saint Aloysius of the sacred sandal, okay.
Oh.
But this is a public school whose symbol is a Christian Knight Templar.
Oh my God.
With the Crusader cross on his shield.
My
and,
God.
And on the one hand, I'm thinking, you know, there's some church and state problems here. But on the other hand, I was thinking, that is ironically realistic. Because the Christian Crusader Knights were raiders for the cross.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I love the places you take my mind, Diane. I do.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I'm so happy for Doodle and about the graduation. Never thought I'd hear about that kind of symbolism. I thought you were going to say they were talking about... Well, I knew you weren't going to say this, but it crossed my mind that it could be Wall Street raiders, you know.
Well, and that's the thing. If somebody was to raise a ruckus and say, look, you've got a crusader and a crusader cross, you can still be the raiders, but why don't you change it to a black, a silhouette in black of a guy in a suit with a briefcase?
Oh, that's disgusting. That would be disgusting, don't you think? I mean, it would be a funny retort on your part, but... I wouldn't want to graduate from a high school with that kind of symbol. But, yeah, I wonder if the kids know that history. I mean,
Well, I sat down with Doodle afterward, and I said, did you ever notice what your mascot is?
Goes, maybe some of them have read the Da Vinci Code or something.
Well, Doodle, I said, did you ever notice what your mascot is? And she goes, no, Dad, but I'm pretty sure you did, and I'm about to find out.
You told her.
Honestly, Dad, everything doesn't have a symbolic meaning. And yes, it does.
Everything does. Yeah. Well.
What I want to know, though, is whether someone was trying to ironically poke truth at the Crusader, at the Christian Crusader past, or did they just see, okay, well, it's going to be a raider, and we're going to put a cross on the shield, okay? Because we love Jesus.
No. Fascinating to know, because by this time it's just taken for granted, and the meaning's been largely lost. But it's weird because that has a very profound meaning, and they're walking around with it.
I couldn't stop looking at it.
Oh my God, that's the last thing I thought you'd. I mean, I came from a high school where we were raiders, but I think it had more to do with. I don't even know what it had to do with, quite frankly. Raiders, Shawnee Mission Raiders. I don't know. I don't remember. But I'm pretty sure it wasn't about the Crusades. Anyway.
But I just sat there looking at it and ruminating on it. Because when I went to high school, we were Bruins. You know, we were Bears. We were
Bears.
Bruins. Bruins. Yeah, Bruins. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that makes sense.
And we probably had the most unappealing color combination. The older high school across town was black and gold, so we were brown and orange.
Oh, like Halloween. Well, yeah. Well, you know, on that note, I should let you go so you can do your closings. And thank you for the conversation, which went all the way from the morons in Topeka on to the Crusades. I mean... God only knows how we get that far.
we span the globe and the epochs of time, Diane. It was a lovely conversation, and I thank you.
I thank you, Bob.
Bye
later.
Now.
Later.
The marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Stan. It is time to get out of here. We will begin the program tomorrow seeking to raise $350 because, well, bless your heart for being there, Randy. You were the only one. Thank you very kindly. Hopefully, maybe in the next 24 hours, we'll close the deficit. That would be awfully nice. Thank you to everyone who makes all of this happen, you with your kind contributions, you who listen and send your input and your engaging conversation in the chat room, who listen and seldom, if ever, write and sometimes do and surprise me and give me new people to think about. Thank you, one and all. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACAC.org. And, yes, always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.